Hello and welcome back to Secrets Behind the Music Business. I'm your host, Barry Victor, and today we have with us a special guest, entertainment and intellectual property attorney, Richard Jefferson of the Metal Law Group. Richard, how you doing today?
I'm doing good. Hi, everybody.
Hey. So we just want to get right into it and get some of this wisdom that you have for us. But first, can you tell us how you got into the entertainment and intellectual property side of the legal field and what that journey was like for you?
Okay, well, actually, I started out as a manager. I used to work for a management company when I lived in Florida, and we used to manage groups, 95 South, 69 Boys, some of those, you know, late 90 groups, and I was part of it, and I just started seeing some bad deals come through. I didn't understand why we weren't getting paid off of certain things, so it kind of prompted me to get ready and go to law school. So I went to law school to try to figure all these weird contracts out. And, you know, fast forward, I guess that was 98. I came and went to law school. So that, you know, it's been a while. And here I am. It's been a long journey.
So when you became a manager, was that just something that you were doing for a friend, or how did that come about?
Yeah, I was actually, during the day, I had a day job, but at night I would help a friend out. He was actually the main manager, and I was just kind of helping with the groups and, you know, trying to help with the books, and I was trying to learn the business. And, you know, once everybody was completely confused about the contracts and the money wasn't coming in, that's when I was like, you know, that someone needs to figure all this stuff out and kind of make it easier for the smaller indie companies and artists to kind of know where their money's coming from.
Right.
And what to avoid.
So with no previous experience in the music industry, how did you know that these contracts weren't right?
Really, it's from the paychecks. I mean, or the lack thereof, really. We weren't getting paid. I think if you remember Tootsie Roll, that song from back in the 90s?
Yes.
I mean, it spun a lot. I mean, it was the number one song for many weeks and did plenty of tours. And then, you know, at the end of the day, got a very small check for it, and it just was completely, you know, people always think that all these artists are rich and famous, but truthfully they're only famous. I mean, a lot of times if they don't handle their money right, it goes away, and or they never see it, and a lot of it ties all the way back to the contracts. When you start questioning things, if you didn't negotiate the proper terms in the first place, you have no leg to stand on. So that's really what prompted me to try to figure out the business.
Wow, that's great. So you kind of just became an advocate because you saw the things that weren't right within the industry. That's pretty extraordinary, because a lot of people, you know, either they don't understand it and they still roll with it, or sometimes they're benefited from it while the artist may not. And, you know, they might still go ahead with it. So I commend you on being one of those people that's like, nah, I want to see these creators actually be compensated for the things that they're doing.
Yeah, I mean, I come from a creative family, so I think that's kind of where it's bred. My father was a musician, so, and, you know, I was somewhat of a musician, so it kind of started from there. I think I've always been on their side. And even now, I may not be an artist attorney. I'm more of a small label indie guy, because I think that's where the business kind of meets the creative in a better way than just representing artists. But still, I always look out. I always want the artists to look out for themselves and get what they're due.
With there being such an independent scene now, do you think that there are still these type of deals going on, or has that minimized since the labels are downsizing and people are handling most of the business on their own? When you're independent, do you still run into those situations where you're not getting a lot of the money that you're owed?
Yeah, well, now it's a different, it's kind of a different animal. I mean, and it's kind of similar, because back then things were, they were changing format, and a lot of the confusion or mystery is when things are changing in the industry. Back in the 90s, things were changing from, you know, cassette tapes to CDs, and they were treating CDs as like new technology, so they were paying less on it, and no one knew why, but no one knew how to justify why it was wrong. You know, nowadays, now it's streaming. You know, this year, streaming is going to overtake any kind of downloading or sale of CDs. So that's where that's where the mystery is now. And I mean, if you Google on the internet, that's all artists talk about. Like, I don't know why I'm not getting paid very much. I'm getting streamed millions of times through these services. And and the industry is making more money than ever, but it's not trickling down to the indie artists or the indie labels. So it's there's always something, and it's kind of a, you know, the music industry is kind of like a game that when something's figured out, they change it, and that's what's happening right now. Right. So they're moving the goalposts.
Right. Okay. So in regards to that, like I guess for streaming, something that people should be signed up with is Sound Exchange. So outside of Sound Exchange, what are some associations or organizations that you feel are mandatory for every artist to be registered with to increase the opportunity of collecting their income?
Well, they definitely need to be with a PRO or performing rights organization like ASCAP or BMI or CSAT. And there's actually a new one. I can't think of the name right now, but there's a fourth one that's actually pretty good as
GMR?
Well. GMR, yeah, GMR. GMR is good. I think they're very selective on who they take in, but they're very much an advocate. You know, they have Pharrell and some big artists that they collect for. Sound Exchange is important, definitely. And aside from that, I mean, I think it's just more about you being on your business, because a lot of the other money you're going to be earning is outside of what's earned by your music. But it's more about the brand now. So if you're licensed, if you're being sponsored, you're sponsoring something, or you're being sponsored, or you're endorsing a product, doing these licensing deals, I think that's where you have to start thinking about intellectual property. And that's where it crosses over, because, you know, if you're using your name on a product, that means that you should have a trademark registered, right, that you can license, and then you make money off that license.
Right.
Yeah, I tell people that the industry's kind of changed from a copyright heavy industry to a trademark heavy industry now, and trademarks are more valuable than the copyright sometimes.
Right. I do want to jump more into that and take it a little deeper, but before we go there, I've been trying to understand where MediaNet plays a role in all of this. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but I heard that it was similar to Music Reports and Harry Fox. Are you familiar with MediaNet?
Well, MediaNet, they're more like an aggregator where they look to collect royalties from different streams of income. So they're kind of like a point person. So they've got contacts with all these different types of agencies. Like everybody doesn't go through Sound Exchange. You know, Sound Exchange is just for the recorded transmission. So it's mostly like satellite music. They also have like other streaming, like maybe some digital services. But there are a lot of other areas, like YouTube doesn't go through Sound Exchange. That's something that one of these companies would do, and they would aggregate when you have a video and then someone plays maybe your song on top of the video.
Right.
Well, that ad revenue share pays out, but that wouldn't go to Sound Exchange. That would go to one of these companies that associates with YouTube and collects on your behalf.
Okay.
So there are a lot of different types of digital royalties and streams of income that aren't collected by maybe your ASCAP or your Sound Exchange, but they're out there. And if you don't know to go out and collect it, you can't. You just kind of forfeit it, or it becomes unclaimed money. So that's why these other organizations have popped up to kind of who know where that money is, and then you join them, and they collect it for you.
Okay. So can you associate with all three of those: Harry Fox, MediaNet, and Music Reports? And can you sign up with them as an independent artist, or do you have to be like a publisher or a label? How does it actually work?
I know Music Reports, you don't have to. I mean, you can sign up directly. I'm not sure about the other two, and I'm not sure about the exclusivity part of it either. But the artists I know that have all gone through Music Reports, and it seems like they're pretty good. You know, they've always been and pretty straight up. And I've known Music Report since before they even did this service. They used to place a lot of music in film and TV, and they were pretty reputable there. So that's why I always send people that way.
Got it. Got it. Okay. Now to jump back into the intellectual property side. Oh, excuse me. I'm getting a loud sound outside.
Okay.
But so for the people who don't necessarily understand what intellectual property is, what are some of the, I don't know if the term to use is products, or what are some of the tangible or intangible things that can be considered intellectual property for people who are entering the music business that they can actually monetize? Can you just give us some of the most basic ones?
Yeah, well, the two main ones for music are copyrights and trademarks. And copyrights are anything creatively made, and that would include music. Anything that you create and you actually put it into a tangible form, like a CD or like a digital file. So if you're singing on a digital file, you've created something and you have a copyright. Music, there are two copyrights. There's the the underlying composition, so the notes that you've written that you plan to sing in the recording session, that's one copyright. That's lyrical copyright, and you would do a PA copyright form for that. And once you record it, that's a second copyright. So that's the sound recording copyright, or an SR. So you have two copyrights, and that's the main thing for people to understand. You have two separate copyrights when you have a finished recorded product, and each one can generate its own income, its own royalties. If you license a finished song to a television show and you want them to they play your song while someone's watching, you know, a show, that's two different incomes. That's a master use license, and that's for the sound recording, and then that's the sync license for the composition. So that a lot of times people kind of get tripped up because there might be one license that includes both copyrights, and that's not how it's supposed to work, and that needs to be clarified. A lot of times they should be equal. So if you get $1,000 for your sync license, you get $1,000 for the master use license.
Right.
So that's the short version of the copyright.
Okay.
And then you have the trademarks. So trademarks are related to any kind of good or service that you're providing. So you can have a number of different trademarks. So the United States Trademark Office has divided up all goods and services across the United States that are sold into 45 categories. So if you can have a trademark in each one of those 45, ideally. I mean, that's not likely, because you're not likely going to make every different type of product. But someone like Taylor Swift has maybe like 20 trademarks, because one trademark's related to her sound recording, like her selling her music. Mm-hmm. One trademark is related to her selling clothing. One trademark is related to her selling, furniture. I mean, she has everything. So one could be related to her mobile app. I mean, so they're all, instead of when people say trademark, it's not just your name. It's actually your name tied to some product or some service. And so you can imagine, that can be very valuable. If you're a well-known brand like Oprah, you know, you can put your name on anything and you can make money. So you would want to trademark in as many associated with as many products as possible.
Right. Now, are there ways to, I want to say, to decrease the cost of that based on all of those different categories? Because through what I've researched, it's like you have to pay for each one individually. But if you're an independent artist, each one of those applications is what, around like $400 or something? So how can somebody possibly pay for all of those? Or should you just wait until you're like, okay, now I'm going to sell socks, and then now I'm going to sell pillowcases? Should you just wait, or should you just put your stuff out there?
Well, I would tell people that, you know, they should kind of roll it out based off of what they're going to be doing. I mean, if there's no way to really save on the applications, because each one is it's between like we charge like between $1,200 and $1,500, and it takes about a year to go through. So it's a pretty involved process.
Right.
But I always encourage artists to start with the first two that are main. The main one is recorded music and live performance for music, because you're going to be, you know, you're going to be making music and you're going to be touring. So you want to make sure that not only that you own the trademarks, but you want to, for the purpose of licensing, but you also want to make sure that you're clear enough to use that name so no one else can come around and say, oh, you got to change your name, or you got to change your logo. You know, that's going to cost you way more than applying for a trademark, trying to remarket yourself and rebrand yourself.
When you say live recording, do you mean the actual name, or do you mean the sound recording when you say trademark the live recording?
There's a live performance category to get a trademark. So when you're touring and someone wants to use your name for a concert, you want to have rights to your name in relation to live performances, concerts. That's a separate trademark from a trademark related to selling recorded music.
Got you. Okay, that makes sense.
So that's where a lot, I mean, I'm sure everyone's heard the story of people getting tripped up and having to change their name, mm-hmm. you know, after they've been out for a while. And that's the basis of what happens. An early example was, you know, Common. You know, Common used to be called Common Sense. And there was a dispute because there was another Common Sense that was already out there. He must not have gone through the proper channels of trademarking his name, and he lost the right to use his name, the name Common Sense, so he had to change it to Common. So, you know, it's hard to rebrand yourself. That's hard and very expensive. So when people say trademarks are expensive, I'm like, well, you know, just think about what if you get into your career for a year or two and then you have to change your name. I mean, that's going to cost you way more than just being upfront and getting everything in order.
Yeah. So is that kind of like the first order of business, that if someone's setting up their music entity, would you say go ahead and trademark your record label name and your stage name before you even go and file a LLC or a DBA or start putting your name on records? Is that the first order of business?
Yeah, I think trademarks, I think trademark is probably the first order of business. A lot of times LLCs or a formation of some kind of something that protects you is very close. I mean, a typical setup of like a label or an artist kind of production company or whatever is dealing with the trademark, an LLC, and then contracts. Like that's usually what is like a startup package kind of thing. You know, those are all kind of equally important. It's hard to put one in front of the other, but the name is very important. I mean, the name, you can do like what's called an intent to use name, where you reserve the name. You can go through the process, and that way you kind of find out if there is going to be a problem, and that kind of reserves your rights. So, you know, when you are ready to come out, then you've already gone through that process and you don't have to worry about it.
Got it.
So that's usually what I recommend.
Okay. So what are some other resources that independent artists can utilize to get legal assistance if they don't have necessarily the money to reach out to someone like yourself right now, or there are organizations that give information or give advice to those upcoming artists?
There are a lot. I mean, first of all, if someone is part of ASCAP or BMI or CSAC, they usually have some kind of resources. So, I mean, I encourage people to always use those. I even do seminars sometimes for different organizations. And there are a lot of things I can go to around town where they're like free seminars. People will talk about, you know, different legal topics, just kind of like this. I mean, I'm sure this might help some people kind of at least identify the issues. I personally have a site called lawyersrock.com, and I sell agreements off it, which are actually inexpensive, because a lot of people come to me and, you know, you're right, they can't afford an attorney, but I'd rather have them sign some, you know, have some kind of paperwork in place for their situation than just kind of like throw their arms up and be like, oh, well, let's, I'm not going to cover myself, you know, because then they're really screwed if they don't like engage in contracts and actually protect themselves.
Yeah.
So that, this California Lawyers of the Arts is actually a nonprofit that a lot of creative people go to. I've done a couple presentations for them. They're good. They're a lot of startup lawyers go there and kind of lend their time to that as a nonprofit type of situation. So it's really just about searching around. I know some people are like all or nothing with lawyers, but I mean there's a lot of middle ground. There's a lot of good information out there, and they're got good sources. If you follow even the Grammys, if you go to the Grammys, like the Grammys.com or the Grammys organization, they sponsor a lot of good programs. So they give a lot of good free information or information to their members. So I would just focus on credible sources and then look and start digging in from there.
Good. That's great information. I know people would probably like starting out going to those sites after they hear this. So I know you mentioned just like getting certain things down on paper and contracts. Can you clarify in terms of who owns a master recording? I've had people ask this question about who owns the master recording if you go to a studio and you're recording on their equipment and then you're just paying them the hourly rate for whatever it is. Does the studio you're renting from still have an ownership in that master recording?
Well, that's the gray area, because I mean technically they do, because if you don't have certain language in the paperwork that actually says, you know, this is a work for hire, then technically the one who created it, like the studio engineer, would be the owner of the master recording. That's why you never want to get in that kind of situation. I mean, if you're paying money, you want to make sure money doesn't exchange hands until paperwork is signed.
Right.
Because you want to make sure you're, even if it's simple, it doesn't have to be like long pages of legalese, and it doesn't have to be that difficult. It just has to be something with the magical language that is required by the Copyright Act that says that you're the owner of the sound recording. That's definitely been I've dealt with that a lot over the years, because people kind of do that a lot. They'll kind of treat, you know, recording music like it's like going to the store and buying milk. You know, it's like I paid for it, I'm walking out the door, I own it. That's not how it is. You need to have the proper language transferring or actually saying that it's a work for hire for you, and you're the owner and the author, and then you copyright that as your work.
Right.
So that's a good point. I'm glad you brought that up.
Thank you. Yeah. So does that still apply even if you bring your own engineer to the studio? Because essentially it's still the recording studio's equipment.
Yeah, I mean, that could get into a gray area. I mean, it's hard for me to see a studio, you know, trying to take the position that they own. Like, if you bring your own recording engineer and you're paying him, it's hard for me to see a studio take that position. But from a legal standpoint, they could, because it wasn't done properly.
Right. It just seems like people are just so used to going into the studios and recording and then leaving with the master recording and feeling like this is mine. How did that become something that wasn't ever considered, like, okay, the studios is going to try to sue me or own the masters? Because I don't even think this is something that's on people's mind.
I could see it coming up in a different situation, though, because I mean, sure, I think we all know that if you go and record and then you leave and everything's good and fine with the studio, then they're not going to make any kind of waves for you. But what if you went over on the session and they think you owed additional money versus you thinking that it's over and you're just like, I'm not going to pay that extra money or something. There's some kind of dispute, you know. Mm-hmm. then they could pull out some different legal tricks and kind of hem you up with that. And that's, I mean, if I was an attorney for the sound recording studio, I would do that. I would say, okay, well, you're not going to pay our money. I'm going to pull your stuff down from the internet because we own it. You know, I try to think of myself as a good lawyer, but I have to think of how to be the evil lawyer too, because I deal with a lot of these evil lawyers. Mm-hmm. So you kind of have to know both sides of it.
Well, thank you for clarifying that. That's good to know. So to transition a little bit, I want to know, what are record labels best used for in this day and age? What's your take on that?
Oh, definitely marketing. I just had this conversation because I signed a couple artists this past year, and just like we talked about, it's like, where's the money? It's hard to see where the money goes, and advances are lower now, and they're not even focusing on selling records anymore. It's all about, they throw the music out there to stream, and then they're trying to brand the artist. So, I mean, what value is the record label? I mean, well, the value is marketing. They're able to get your name out there, and they'll make you famous. And, you know, like we talked about at the beginning, people think people who are rich are famous and rich, that they're not necessarily rich, even though they're famous. And a label deal sometimes will make you famous, but it won't make you rich. But they've always been master marketers, and especially with all the consolidations of the record labels now. And I mean, they're only three. I mean, when I started, there were like seven or eight. Mm-hmm. Majors. Now it's, it's down to three. So they're all intertwined with the movie and TV industry. So that, they can cross promote you and make you a household name. That's where it comes. You got to figure out how you're going to get paid off of this. How you going to make your money?
So it seems like they're more like becoming entertainment companies versus solely just record companies.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. There are different levels. There are the majors, and there are the mid-majors even. The middle company that do the same thing. They're all entertainment companies at different levels, mm-hmm. and they're all trying to cross-market. But their goals are to make you a household name so they can put you on a product and somebody will see them. And like, oh, I know them. I want something that says Ty Dolla $ign on it, or, something, somebody who's known. That's kind of how they operate.
Got it. So under what circumstances, if you do, would you advise an artist to sign a 360 deal?
I honestly, and I've had this conversation with the artist, I honestly don't believe in those deals, but it's gonna be a balance. It's going to have to be a balance, because if I have a successful indie artist who's offered a 360 deal, I mean, we're going to have to, within that 360 deal, we're going to have to carve out some things that artist has already accomplished and kind of keep on their own before I would suggest going for a 360 deal. 360 deals, that's all they're offering now. And for new artists, they really don't have a choice. That's all they're, it's either that or nothing, pretty much. Mm-hmm. For an established artist, they kind of have a choice, because I really think, like we just said, talked about, what their purpose is. A major will make you famous, but you may make more money as an independent artist. Just won't be as known. Right. So it depends on what that artist wants to be. If they want to be famous, then and I had a couple of artists this past year who just wanted to be famous. They just wanted to be on a major. I mean, that was their lifelong dream. They weren't looking to be. To be, trying to hustle and be a rich indie artist. So that's probably the best answer I can give, because I'm kind of against those. When those came out, I was really against those provisions and those contracts. And they turned out to be the main thing that you negotiate now in major deals, is because that's where the money is, and everything outside of the recording money. Any attorney who's been around for a while, it probably has a bad taste in their mouth from the 360 deal.
Yeah. So what does a typical deal look like for, let's say, a very, very talented artist, but they have no track record? When they get signed to a major label, what typically will they be giving up?
Well, I mean, first of all, the major label's gonna want everything under the sun. I mean, that's how the first draft will come over. They want to just basically own you, everything. I mean, they want to own your social media. They want to own your web presence. They want to own your touring. They want to own any branding you might do, any ventures you might do in acting and or anything else. It's just going to come over totally. Just give us everything, and we'll give you a little money. That's the first deal. So from there, that's where you negotiate. I mean, you have to figure out what to carve out and what to kind of give and take on, and what money to try to get the money up. So I mean, that's all part of the whole negotiation. But I mean, even with labels though, that there's a threshold before they're even interested. I mean, you're going to have some kind of success on social media or with some fan base that you're bringing before they're going to even offer you a deal. So that's what's changed a little bit over the years. There's less development.
Now, when you say they wanna own your social media, is that considered your intellectual property as well?
Yes. Social media is technically it's called like intangible assets.
Okay.
And intangible assets are kind of out. Intellectual property is like a subset of intangible assets, and intangible assets are things like your social media and maybe contracts that you've signed. Things that you can't really put your hand on, as far as like, it's not like real property, like a building or anything, but it's property that's valuable
Right.
and hard to. So that's they're gonna want everything like that, because basically they want to take you and they want to brand you, and they want to do it in the way that they want to, in the way that they like to brand their artists.
Now, are the labels very aggressive in retaining those rights from you? Like, say you go into a situation and you've already handled all the legal paperwork, like you signed yourself to your own label, you have your own publishing company, you own your trademarks and your copyrights, and then the label is interested. Do you play hardball with them, or are they most likely still going to want to get those rights from you?
Depends on the label, I think. There are different types of label deals too. I mean, there's the all out label deal for that new artist who doesn't have a lot, and then the situation you're talking about where you've kind of got everything together, and the label just going to come through and maybe distribute you or just market and promote you. So that those deals look a little bit different. You have a little. It's all about negotiating leverage. I mean, you have more leverage to kind of push back on a label with that second scenario.
Okay. So as an attorney with access to record executives, do you make it a part of your career to shop artists that you find are talented?
Not anymore. I used to do it when I was young, probably back when the industry was more open to that. It's a little more closed now. All the A&Rs and all the execs, they're just heavily looking at social media these days. I mean, even if I have like the best artist in the world, the first question they're going to ask me is what's their following, and that's going to make a bigger decision than for them than who's bringing it to them. Because they're not as focused on, I hate to say it, they're not as focused on quality as they are with success. I mean, it's true though. I mean, it's true. Yeah, I'm sure you shook your head a couple times when you heard a song on the radio, like, how did that guy get on there? But you look at his YouTube, and he's got like 5 million plays on his YouTube videos, and you're just like, okay, well, that's how he got on there. Five million people wanted to see him, so a label's going to be interested to try to get them to 5 million more people.
Okay. So my next question is, when pursuing a music career, what are some of the first things that you should be doing?
Okay, we did talk about the name thing. I think name is very important, to lock down your name. If you're starting to put out music, or you're getting ready to put out music, I think locking down your name so that you can consistently use that name, and getting a trademark on recorded music is probably very, very important. Second thing is really starting to build the buzz with social media. That's just, I can't emphasize that enough, because that's what every executive, I don't care. I work with different areas of entertainment, television, film, digital, music. Every executive always looks towards the social media before they want any artist, any music, any television show. You know, they want to see the social media of the characters on the show. Everything's social media driven. So that's just something you need to, artists need to really focus on. Get the Twitter up, get the Instagram up, get those numbers, the legit numbers up too. You can tell when they're fake. I can tell when they're fake.
Yeah. Is that something that the label does? Do they track that stuff before they consider? Does the label usually go in and try to track the bots?
No, yeah. You can tell. I mean, I understand it's kind of if you mix it and you can attract other people just because you got bigger numbers, you can't have a million fake Twitter followers and try to go out and stop a deal. It's not going to happen.
Right.
But good.
I was just going to say, it doesn't make sense anyway, because I feel like, why have a million followers and then you go and do a show and only five people come? So I think it's better to kind of just go out as who you naturally are. If you can bring 150 people out, then that's great. And then people can gauge you by where you are at that point, not where you're trying to perceive yourself to be at.
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree. And let's see, a third thing, and I always like to give three things when I say something, because that kind of helps. The third thing, I think artists need to understand that it is still a grind. I mean, you got to get out there, you got to perform, you got to meet people. I can't tell you how many times artists have come to me and said, you know, I met so-and-so at this club on Thursday night, you know, totally obscure. There were 10 people in the room, but one turned out to be, you know, an exec. And they really like me. I mean, you just never know where it's going to happen, where the magic's going to happen, or where somebody who knows somebody is going to see you. So it's still a grind. You gotta go to you still need to go to one of the major music cities and do the circuit. I mean, you're in LA, you know, do the Troubadour, do all the Roxy. You do all those places, and you just got to increase your buzz.
How often do you think that A&Rs or other record executives are out there still in the clubs searching for artists? Or just even hanging out?
I think
out?
A lot of it, I mean, I think, I think it's the younger, it's not the major A&Rs aren't going to be out there. They're going to have their younger, I used to be in the A&R, but I used to love it because, you know, ooh, I get to go listen to music. But, that's when you're younger. That's where the older A&R send the young kids to kind of like see what's hot. So even if you're playing, you just see some young 20-somethings out there, you know, don't take it for granted that, like, they're nobodies. Sometimes even they're interns or they're just entry-level A&R assistants, but that's where it starts. You know, if they like you, then that goes move to the next level, and they take it back to their boss. So they're out there. It's definitely there's always people out there looking at this scene, and then it always ties back to, like, they may not go to something unless it's an artist who has a great social media following too. So that's where that might start. They might look you up first, and then they're like, oh, okay, let me go see this person live and see if it translates to what I see on the video. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's a lot of work. Being an artist or an indie label, it's a lot of work, but it's fun work. I think it's, most of my clients feel like it's fun work.
Yeah. So with that being said, knowing that it is a lot of work, who is the first person that an artist should bring on their team?
Well, they definitely need some kind of manager. It doesn't have to be, you know, it could be a relative or someone who believes in them and isn't looking to just get paid, because when you're starting out, you're just not going to get the high level manager. it's just not going to happen. But you need somebody to kind of deal with, set things up, and be your buffer. And, you know, it's hard to do everything yourself, because then you're dealing with, your relationship has to change with people that you're dealing with. It's always good to have like a buffer. Like, if you're dealing with a promoter, you want your manager to deal with them. And if it gets kind of sticky, then the promoter's mad at the manager, not mad at you as the artist. Right. So that's kind of the first, I think that's the first step. You got to have somebody who's acting as your manager.
Yeah, so you don't have to burn those bridges personally.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. And then I think once you get any kind of paperwork, that's when you may want to look for an attorney to make sure you're not signing anything over all your rights early in your career when you shouldn't be signing it.
Okay, so we go from the manager to the attorney. Okay, that's good. So the next part I have is a two-part question. So what are some of the newest ways that an artist can make money? And then the second part, what are the most lucrative ways for an artist to make money?
Newest ways, I'd have to go back to sponsorships and even being a social media influencer. I mean, I did a deal where a guy got paid $10,000 a month to be a social media influencer. He's an artist, but he also does other things. So those deals are out there. I mean, you know, you have to kind of be known a little bit, but to some extent, if you've got a good following, then people are going to want to be a part of your brand. So you can make money that way. I have this one guy, he's an artist, but he's also a gamer, and he got a game company to pay him, X amount of dollars per month to kind of promote himself, the game. But then he also has time where he can kind of introduce new music that he has. I thought that was pretty cool. And then appearances, like once you get to be well known. I mean, this new crop of artists, this YouTube generation, there are tons of ways they make money. They're just like many. It's like a whole parallel celebrity type of thing. Like, yeah, they're just like you know, you got all these big agencies that have the A-list actresses and artists, but YouTube, you can do the exact same thing that they're doing parallel, and you don't have to pay the agent because you're the one. So I think that the sky's the limit. You can sponsor products. You can do jingles for stores. You can do Christmas songs. I mean, there are all kinds of things that artists can do to make money. And you know, part of, and again, like with all the income that you're making, you're writing new music, so you're getting more royalties, and that's how a lot of people just start building up their indie production companies and indie labels, because they're doing all these different things and they own all this intellectual property, because everything you're creating is intellectual property. So then you've got a solid song that you can license to someone. I mean, there's just endless. I know I'm kind of rambling, but I'm just thinking, like, there's so much you can do. You know, even with like VR and AR coming out, I just saw like a deal come across where you know, they're creating like these music rooms in the clubs now, where they can have like music, but they have these like VR things that the goggles you put on, but your music is like the walls are like bouncing to the beat of music, you know, and that's a whole different element of another stream of income. So yeah, there's a ton. Just create the business side of this is becoming as creative as creating the music.
Yeah. So the second part to that question was, what are the most lucrative ways that you've seen? Is it merchandise nowadays? Is it touring, like, specifically for independent?
Yeah, I think it's independent. I think touring is still, it's always going to be king, because I mean, you're going to get a bigger payday per concert if you get the crowd there. And then merchandising, yeah, definitely. Like, if you're selling popular merchandising, that's good. But I'm also thinking about, like, one of my biggest indie artists. She makes the most money with her endorsements of products. So there's a, like, she has a hairspray that she uses, and she always gives them a shout out in her music videos.
Oh, nice.
Clothing, you know, she has another sponsor who dresses her in her music videos or her appearances or on in her concerts. Anything that you can think of that kind of that you can wear or you can show or you can use, that's where the bigger money is.
Okay.
I think because those brands, they consider that more marketing money versus anything else, and marketing budgets are always the big budgets, so they have no problem paying you, like, you know, $20,000 to rock a cool hat on a video or where you're making an appearance. You know, they'll pay you $20,000 because they're getting all the exposure, where they're going to sell tons of products way more than what they just paid you.
Right.
So I think endorsements and sponsorships, that's probably the, and touring's always going to be there, but endorsements and sponsorships, that's where the big ticket is.
Okay, so what's your advice on how to actually get those opportunities if you want to do jingles, you want to get sponsorships, endorsements, if you're not someone who already has a name? Is that possible? I mean, I know anything is possible, but is it very rare, I would say, for someone who doesn't have a large following? Or can someone who's very brand new just go out and, you know, maybe go to a car dealership and say, hey, I want to do a jingle for you, and it's likely to happen?
Yeah, I mean, it's possible to happen. It's just about the level of your expectations. I mean, I think everybody out there is looking for a benefit, a win-win. So any smaller, you're not going to go out there and tell Coke, you know, ooh, I want to be, you know, sing your jingle. But if it's like anything local, like you said, car dealerships or local businesses, you know, they're all looking for those type of things, like jingles or nice, a good singer to actually give them maybe like music for their website or something like that. You know, they have to pay for it. If they don't, if you go out there and you're saying, look, I'll do it for free if we swap, and you start, you might have to start for free and then get yourself started to be known, and then as you start getting your following, then you can start charging because people are going to start coming to you. It's just a step, you know, stepping stone. You're going to have to start somewhere, so you might as well practice your craft while you're building yourself up, and then as you improve, then that's when you can start charging people for things.
Okay.
And cross promoting, you know. I mean, maybe, and you look for what might be beneficial for you. If there's a certain audience you may want to get in front of, and that business is in front of it already, then that'd be the perfect situation for you to do something for that company for free, because you're going to get in front of that audience that likes your music, and then they're going to go to and buy it. So that's where the research will come into play. You kind of find what's going to be beneficial for you, where the other person doesn't have to pay, and that's beneficial for them, and, you know, you elevate it that way.
Yeah, I can see that working out. Like, maybe if you're like a vegetarian or a fitness guru or something like that, there are companies who would want to partner with you.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So my final question, and this is the one that I think would be most important, because a lot of people are trying to transition from the 9-to-5 into having a career full time. So I want to know, through your experience, how common is it that you actually see your clients get to make a living from their music careers and they're not signed to a major label and they're not celebrities at all? Like, what are the best practices that they use to sustain a full-time career? And I mean, anywhere from $60,000 to $100,000 a year, you know, people can live off of that.
Mm-hmm.
How often does that come across your table?
Comes across a lot more recently, within the last couple of years, than it used to be. I mean, 5 years ago, I may have said, you know, it's tough. You're going to have to keep your day job and kind of build it. But, I mean, I've got YouTubers that have be their artists or actors or whatever, that have started YouTube channels, and they're easily making $10,000-$12,000 a month, easily. I mean, and they've built up within the last year or two. So there is no formula. I can't tell you exactly how it works, and you know, for each situation, but I've seen it flip a lot in the last couple of years. Especially with, you know, with the emergence of social media, it's such an easy way, format to get things out there now. So if you're an excellent singer, I've got this amazing indie artist, and she started probably 4 or 5 years ago, I would say. And she struggled the first couple of years because she was just doing the 9-to-5 plus then trying to build a career. But then once she, like, after, I can't remember which platform, she started like a YouTube channel, and then she started getting hit, and then she started getting people who wanted to endorse her and put their products with her and make appearances. And I mean, I'm sure she's making at least 6 figures right now. Yeah, she's definitely making 6 figures now. And that's, you know, really that's mostly in the last 2 or 3 years. So it's doable. It's definitely doable right now. I wouldn't want anyone to have just quit their job and jump into it. I mean, you still have to transition, but mm-hmm. it's doable.
Yeah, I mean, that's very inspiring, because it seems like nowadays maybe it is more of a reality that you can make this happen full time, versus when only the major labels were giving people opportunities. So it actually seems like it kind of flipped.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people need to think outside the box of music, because it's just not. If you go to like Vid, you ever kind of heard of VidCon?
Yes,
it's like a conference for YouTubers. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of those YouTubers are musicians, and you'll meet a lot of successful people at those things. You've got to think outside the box of the music industry, because that's not. It'd be tough for you to make a lot of money just thinking music. You gotta expand your horizon, and you know, think more entertainment. Just like we were talking about with how the company's expanded to entertainment. You gotta expand your mindset to be an entertainer, not just a musician.
Right. Well, we've covered a whole lot. I'm excited to be able to release this episode, but I do want to know. Are there certain things that you want to share that you feel are very important that maybe I didn't ask you?
I think we touched a lot on it, but I think at the end, I think it's just all about inspiration. I mean, and motivation. A lot of people just see certain. They think that there's a cookie cutter way of doing things, and there's not. I've seen success come in many different formats and, mm-hmm. and many different ways. So I think I would just want to tell your audience, just find out what fits for you and do it. Don't try to mimic someone else. I mean, you can look to other people for comparisons and maybe, you know, what went right and what went wrong. But if it's not a fit for you, don't try to fit yourself into that. I've been so inspired actually by a lot of the success that I've seen since I've moved out here. Mm-hmm. No one's story is the same at all. And it's, but you know, once they get to where they are, it's amazing. It's amazing how you can just talk about your past. Mm-hmm. So that's probably the best thing I could tell people. You know, I mean, I would have never thought I'd be an LA lawyer. I'm from Ohio originally.
Oh, cool.
So, you know, my path is, my path is totally different than any other entertainment attorney. Yeah. I just tell people that same thing. If it's your dream, just go after it.
Yeah, and I think the door is wide open, like you said, for people's different paths, because I see people who are entering this genre of so-called hip-hop, but then some people are coming at it from a perspective of, I'm going to be an environmental hip-hop artist. I know a lady who considers herself the mom rapper, and then I know a guy who's like the video game rapper, and all he raps about is like Comic Cons and different characters and things like that. But these people are, you know, they're traveling overseas and they're being able to get themselves into certain arenas because they found their niche. And so it's like you can actually be anything that you want to be nowadays, and the people are very open to it.
You're
you don't
have
to be the same artist from the '90s where, you know, there was a certain style or there was a certain cadence. It's like the door is wide open.
Yeah, and you touched on an important point too, because I mean, as far as, like I was saying, expand your horizons outside of music industry, you know, expand your horizons outside of the United States, because a lot of success from some of the artists I've seen have started in other countries and then they came back and more successful. Because like if you're on social media, maybe you have a lot of followers from another country, that's how that you get built up, and then people here start clicking in and, you know, notice of you. So you're not limited. You know, just because someone here doesn't get you doesn't mean someone else in another part of the world won't get you.
Right.
And social media helps that. So.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much, Richard. I appreciate you for just being on the show and sharing so much knowledge and wisdom. Can you let the people know where they can find you at and how they can get in touch with you?
Yeah, I'm probably the easiest way, because people always remember this, is I have a blog called lawyersrock.com. That's probably the easiest way, that if there's a contact page on there. I mean, I have the old stuffy law firm stuff, of course, but I mean, it's metallawgroup.com, but most people remember lawyersrock.com easier. And yeah, just my email's on there, and I also share information there about different topics and occasionally, and it happens in the entertainment industry.
Perfect. Well, I'll be sure to leave that link when we put up the episode and leave the description. So thank you again. It was a pleasure having you, and I hope to talk to you again soon, sometimes in the future, because things are changing all the time. So I know you'll have some new information.
Okay.
All right. Have a good one.
Okay. Sounds good.
Thanks, Rich. Bye.
Okay, you too.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.